Welcome to Apostrophe Cast. In the midst of December, we are proud to bring you the work of poet Mark Leidner. It's difficult to describe Leidner's work without using the word uncanny. And yet, he begins with deceptive simplicity. It's as though we were talking to a friend at a bar or over a phone. And then, before we realize it, our friend has stopped joking and begun speaking in poetry. We hope he becomes your friend as he has become ours. Without further ado, the poetry of Mark Leidner.
My name is Mark Leidner, and I'm going to read 5 poems for this, the Apostrophe Webcast podcast. This first poem is called Cooling the House. I try imagining the things air conditioners would say if they had minds and mouths of their own. Like after a long day trying to cool a really hot house in the middle of summer. And then at night when they can finally turn off because it got cool enough in the house, they go, "Good job today, guys. We really lowered the temperature of air in here." Or if a strange car pulls up into the driveway in the middle of cooling the house without even skipping a beat, they go, "Who the fuck's car is that?" Or let's say someone's grandmother dies and the funeral parlor delivers her body to the house because the family has decided to hold the wake there, and the grandmother was always really mean to her daughter, always reminding her daughter she was disappointed in her, and always belittling the daughter's husband for not bringing in enough money, even though the family was, in actuality, quite well provided for by him. And so while they are cooling everything, the air conditioners are also observing it when they wheel her casket in, and so they go, "Man, I don't want to be an asshole, but I'm sort of glad she's gone. I never really liked her." To which the other air conditioner replies, "Dude, totally. She was a true bitch. Good riddance." Meanwhile, wanting to nod, but being held well in place by a few screws to the window pane and pinned under the weight of the top half of the window itself, it cannot. So it does the only thing it can do, which is go on cooling the house. This second poem is called 2 Classic Moments. I'm going to take a sip of water. And this poem is in 2 parts, so 2 Classic Moments, part 1. My favorite point in any film is when the hero gets delivered some piece of devastating news, completely unforeseen by him. His face contorts as he winces. "What?" And the color drains out of his cheeks as he drops to his knees and raises his eyes to the sky and goes, "No!" As the camera swivels around while panning back until he becomes a perpetually shrinking 3-dimensional speck at the center of a perpetually burgeoning field, which his original "no" and its pitch-shifted echoes are stretching and thinning to fill. Although, I realize this doesn't happen in that many films. I think it happens in Aladdin, when sinister Jafar is being sucked down through that shanky pink cyclone of his own necromancy to be sealed in that plain black lamp. After having been tricked into wishing to wield the genie's power. But I can't really remember. Also, Jafar was not the hero in Aladdin, so... But I know for a fact that it happens in the Fellowship of the Ring, when the Balrog's long orange whip catches Gandalf's leg. And hanging by his fingers from the ledge formed from the rubble of the bridge of Khazad Dûm, Gandalf goes, "Fly, you fools!" and lets go. And as his body disappears into the abyss, Frodo does it. No! I know because I'm watching that film right now as I think this. Frodo's doing that right now. I also love it when that moment happens in real life, only not to me. I wish it happened to my enemies more, except I have no enemies. Once it happened to my brother, I remember it vividly. I stood at the foot of his hospital bed as the articulate doctor explained his cheeks had shattered. The bridge of his nose and the sockets holding his eyes had collapsed, and he was going to need a dozen tiny titanium plates and thousands of dollars worth of reconstructive surgery later. Regaining any sight in either eye was still unlikely. By the way, my brother's a drunk and he wasn't insured. He's pretty much been a burden on anyone who ever loved him. Anyway, while the doctor talked, I saw that moment coming from so far away. It was hard not to smile. 2. Another classic moment in film is when the enemy army is poised to attack and all the good guys are all dug in and the general of the good guys is walking in a line behind his troops, eyes on the ground, calculating when it will be the perfect moment to give the order to fire. And all the good guys are hunched in their turrets with their index fingers twitching in their trigger guards, sweat cascading off their faces, since most of them are pukes or noobs or whatever, they're inexperienced. When suddenly the general's voice booms from behind, "Fire at will!" And all the good guys start to fire. All that is, except one, who's like this buck-tooth hick named Clem or Doofus, who turns around and gawking at the general asks, "Will? Who's Will?" And all the other soldiers cease firing and turn around too, and a long silence fills the bunker. The general's face is red, glowing like an ember, like his inner military rage is cooking him from the inside, and for a second you think he'll explode all over Clem and the others, splattering the bunker with blood and flesh, sliding down the walls until the glow recedes and his whole face relaxes and he grins. He sort of chuckles, faintly at first, rubbing his temples in disbelief, shaking his head. He can't believe it, which slowly builds into normal laughter as some of the other soldiers join in, looking around the bunker to check. Yep, other people are laughing. Okay, I guess I'll laugh too. And every soldier goes through that, until the whole bunker is shaking with laughter, with the general in the center, now rolling on the ground and drooling like an epileptic hound, pounding the floor with his palms and trying to stop. But it gets louder and louder and louder. And Clem's just sort of standing there, wondering what all's going on, sort of laughing to himself, but still sincerely wondering who Will really is, and worrying about the enemy, which is still coming, closing whatever little distance remains between the two armies, the way that storm clouds move toward whatever they're moving toward, or the great invisible lashes of radiation winging broadly through outer space, if affected at all by the magnetic fields created by the planets in their way, only trivially affected. Meanwhile, the bunker continues in its state of explosive, nervous, differentiated laughter, sparkling like a jewel or a star to the enemy army all around it. This next poem, excuse me, is called This Is What It Must Be Like. And this, here it goes. This is what it must be like. When something small is rustling on the sidewalk, and I look down to see what that thing is, and it's $20, so I stuff it in my pocket. And I hear something else rustling a few feet away, and I look, and it's $20 too, so I stuff it in my pocket. And I look around to see if anyone saw me, but no one's there. And I look down to check for any more money, but that was it. I got it all, $40. And I look up, and the sky is extremely blue, with a tiny gray cloud in the center. I think, whoa, this is what it must be like. Then later, I'm running around in this nature preserve, and I see a deer and I startle it and it disappears into the trees. And I think, okay, a single deer, that's not too bad. But then around the next bend in the trail, a second deer sees me coming and freezes for a second before it disappears into the trees too. And I'm like, two? What is this, my lucky day? And I'm jogging across this rickety wooden bridge above a stream that comes out into a meadow situated on a hill. And on top of the hill are like 900 deer, maybe 1,000, standing around in a herd like cattle, all of whom are turned toward me and staring me down as if I'm interrupted something that was supposed to have stayed hidden. And the sound of all of them breathing is like this great deafening music. And I can barely breathe myself. And I reach out to touch the trunk of a tree on the edge of the meadow and think, no, this is what it must be like. And this next poem is, I got two more. This next poem is called The River. The River. The woman told me the saddest thing I had ever heard. I told her I loved her because of what she had told me. Her expression soured, She warned me not to love her for her telling me that. She told me it was okay and maybe even good to love her, only not for that. I responded that I did not love her for that exactly, and that she had misunderstood me. I admitted that why I loved her was related to what she had told me, yes, but only tangentially. And was that all right? She asked me to elaborate, so I told her that I loved her, not for the thing she had told me, but for the courage involved in telling someone something like it, something that sad, which seemed to me to be a great deal of courage. And I told her I also loved her, though far less than for the courage part, although plenty still for the way in which she told it to me, which I explained had been, in all seriousness, eloquent and mesmerizing. She had a small build, and at that point she laughed like a flower, wilting and blooming. Her nose was in the center. I decided to show her the river. I picked her up in my hands and carried her, crisscrossing back and down through the steep and elaborate cragwork of the slope of the river bank. When my feet were finally in the water, I looked at her and said, "The river is deep and fast, and it drowns many people, but I still love it." "I still love the river," I told her, "but I do not love it because it is deep and fast and drowns many people. I love it because it runs behind my house, and I have lived above it forever." And finally, this poem is called Speedboat. It's about a speedboat. Speedboat. When you're in a speedboat, pounding out across a sound of choppy water, and the keel is bouncing off the crests, you don't have time to think or analyze. You just hope you're strapped in and you take it all in. The ocean spray shooting up around the vessel, the sunset flashing on the water, the sky shot through with red, the darkening east, the cooling air, your sunburned cheeks, your tousled hair, the rocky outcrop interstitched with coves, rising up severely all along your right, your voluptuous lover on your left, tanned, her hair an animated tangle of branches and flames in the wind, the sunglasses on her face and the hat on your head, and you just take it all in. It doesn't matter where you're going, or where you've been, or what you've got to do when you get there, or what you've just done, because you're in control of a speedboat, and you're cutting a long white crescent of wake through a great twilight harbor, and it's just you, the speedboat, and the sea, and the wind. Maybe you're on your way to the Keys. Then again, maybe you've just come from there and are now on your way to Haiti or Cuba. Maybe you're not even in the Caribbean. You're nowhere near it, lost in the white hell of Hudson Bay or off the coast of Nova Scotia, jousting the frigid surf in search of a remote island rumored to hold buried treasure. And instead of a lover, your sidekick is there. And maybe it's a dog. A giant Labrador, albino, as big as a dinosaur, his giant pink tongue flapping like a long, disgusting flag above the speedboat, slobbering all over the boat, ruining the finish on the back half of the speedboat, and getting slobber all over your expensive treasure-hunting gear in the back seat of the speedboat. But even then, it's still just you and the speedboat, and that dog, and the treasure, if you can find it. And the wind. Thank you for listening. My name is Mark Leidner, and this has been the Apostrophe Podcast. Goodbye.
Join us on September 26th for Richard Nathan.